I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Officials in Pakistan are wondering how a suicide bomber made his way this morning into the heavily fortified UN food compound in Islamabad, killing five. Meanwhile, questions are also being raised today about the use of U.S. troops in far-flung outposts in Afghanistan, meant to stem the flow of insurgents from Pakistan, after eight American soldiers were killed this weekend when 200 insurgents attacked their poorly protected outpost. Military officials have been planning to close the post because of a similar attack last year that left nine U.S. soldiers dead and sparked several investigations, including one launched just last week by General David Petraeus, head of U.S. Central Command, after complaints from the father of one of the soldiers killed. Well, the Washington Post unpacks this whole story in a three-part series and a joint report with CBS News Tonight. Greg Jaffe is national security reporter for the Washington Post and also author of the forthcoming book, The Fourth Star, about four American generals. Greg, let's start with this past weekend. Devastating, but also eerily familiar. So first of all, why hadn't those troops been removed as planned?
You know, it was a bunch of things. There was Afghan politics were involved, military bureaucracy, and then the hardest part was just a shortage of cargo helicopters. Pulling out of those bases is a complicated and dangerous endeavor, so you've got to do it quickly. And it means massing a bunch of cargo helicopters to get everyone out of there fast because you're very vulnerable when you're leaving.
So there's a shortage of the helicopters, but you mentioned the politics. We understand Afghan officials wanted U.S. troops to stay in this outpost through the election so that, what, there wouldn't be a bad signal?
I think so. You know, they didn't want to look weak, and they didn't want to look like they were ceding ground to the Taliban right before the election.
Right. And then to military strategy. Let's talk about that. The criticism is that these troops in these far-flung outposts aren't well protected. Why?
It's just really hard to resupply. You look at the outpost that was attacked on Saturday, it can only be resupplied by air. You can't get armored vehicles or Humvees on the roads because the roads are too narrow. So those guys are fairly alone out there, and it takes, because it's so far, even to get attack helicopters up there to defend them if they get attacked, that takes a very long time.
And the terrain plays into that because the Taliban can get higher than the U.S. troops.
They can, and it's very dangerous to operate helicopters up there even because the high mountains sort of channelize the helicopters. They've got to fly into the valleys because they can't fly over the mountains because the altitude is too high.
So these troops were above the U.S. troops, always giving them the advantage, which brings us to the attack of a year ago in July of 2008 when the same thing happened. About 200 insurgents attacked an outpost in Wanat, killing nine U.S. troops then. And we know a lot more about that now because of several reports that have come out. So, first of all, what do military investigations tell us about what happened that day? Why were those troops so unprotected?
You know, it was one of those missions that they were trying to get in at the end of a deployment the last 2 weeks. Another place, very hard to get to, very hard to resupply the troops.
In fact, they had no construction material for which to build a base. They didn't really have a base. They weren't protected at all because the Afghans that were supposed to drive it in refused to do it.
Right. So once that happened, it was very hard for the military to sort of react. They had a choice at that point where I guess they could have canceled the mission, but they felt like it was important enough to continue to press on. But it became very hard to resupply them. So, you know, they're running out of sandbags, they're running short on water, just a lot of problems.
Well, we know a lot about this, in part because of a father who needed more answers after his son was killed in that battle at Wanat a year ago. This is David Brostrom, retired military. He was the father of Lieutenant Jonathan Brostrom, one of the troops killed. And because of questions the senior Brostrom asked, we know a lot more about what happened that day. What a devastating battle.
It's true. And, you know, he is in a unique position because he's a retired colonel. He kind of knew the right questions to ask, and he knew who to ask them to.
Right. Well, the surviving troops describe a horrible battle, U.S. troops continually falling, their comrades picking up their weapons, but the insurgents close enough to even hear them speaking, the U.S. troops completely overrun. What more did the father in asking questions find out?
I think he found out that commanders just did not do a good job supplying troops, giving troops the basics that they needed to survive out there. I think he also found out that, you know, unmanned aerial surveillance was pulled from the mission about 2 days into the 4.5-day mission because there were just other priorities.
Well, and David Brostrom, again, the father of Lieutenant Jonathan Brostrom, had a hint of this before this attack at Wānaʻat. His son had come home on leave for a visit. They lived in Hawaii and brought with him a video from another post. This was at Bella, another outpost, before they moved to Wānaʻat. It's a video he'd taken of fellow troops. And you describe a powerful exchange as the father watched this video with his son. What was on the tapes? What happened?
Well, the one that affected the father most was the son's platoon had killed some enemy up in the mountains earlier that day. That night, they noticed a campfire, which is just, it's really just a pinprick of light in the area where they had killed those guys. So they call in an artillery strike and a white phosphorus strike, which is an incendiary weapon, on top of it to kill who's ever there. The father becomes very disturbed and says, "How do you know those guys were enemy?" And the son says, basically, "Hey, where I am, everybody's enemy." The father, again, was very disturbed. You know, "How do you know those guys dragging away the bodies weren't just local villagers," something like that. And the son says, "You just don't understand." And he said, "You're right. I don't understand, but I'm worried. I'm really worried."
Because it triggered what? What questions did it trigger at that point?
In his mind, I think it triggered, what the hell is my son doing here? You know, basically, they're in this little tiny outpost in the middle of nowhere. They're not really doing anything other than protecting themselves and trying to fight off the enemy. I think it didn't make sense to him. He couldn't understand what they were achieving or really even trying to achieve out there.
And the original purpose of these outposts was to interrupt insurgent travel from Pakistan. And was that even working?
I think it worked initially. But as the area became more violent and more dangerous, it stopped working. And the troops ended up just kind of protecting themselves. And actually, if you look at the outpost in Nuristan that was attacked on Saturday, that's exactly what was happening.
Well, this father, David Brostrom, did more than just ask questions. He filed for a closer review of deaths at Wānaʻat, this again a year ago. He began talking to a military historian who was doing a report for the military. And David Brostrom has since accused a close friend of his who'd been his son's brigade commander, as well as his son's battalion commander, of negligence. And as we said just last week, because of that, David Petraeus asked for a review. All in all, Greg Jaffe, what do you think the impact of these two attacks, one this past weekend and one a year ago, what do you think the impact is or has been, in the case of a year ago, on the thinking about Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's forced commanders to take a hard look at what they're doing, and especially at these small outposts in kind of remote areas that are dominated by the enemy. They've had to ask themselves, what are we achieving out here? Are we achieving anything, or are we basically just sort of targets out here? And if we're not achieving anything, you know, we've got to get out.
How many other U.S. troops are still in these outposts despite a decision to pull them out?
I don't quite know the exact number, and it's hard to know. I mean, there are probably a half dozen of these outposts out there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they tend to be platoon or company size, 50 to 100.
Yeah, people in each one. And meanwhile, what's happened to David Brostrom, the father who began raising questions a year ago?
Well, this week he's scheduled to fly to Fort Leavenworth to meet with the Marine Corps three-star general who General Petraeus has appointed to lead this investigation. And I think he'll lay out his case that his son's battalion commander and his son's brigade commander, who happens to be a close friend of his, were negligent in the death of his son.
That's Greg Jaffe. He's national security reporter for The Washington Post. He's also author of the forthcoming book, The Fourth Star, about the lives of four prominent Army generals. Greg, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much.
Former Federal Reserve Bank Chair Alan Greenspan was back on TV this past weekend telling ABC's George Stephanopoulos that he thought last week's jobs report was pretty awful, but that there is a silver lining in the economy and no need for another stimulus package yet. Our next guest asks, why is anyone listening to Alan Greenspan? Or, as John Cassidy wrote last week before Greenspan's weekend punditry, a formal renunciation of the Greenspan doctrine is long overdue, and that the economic crisis was not just an indictment of Wall Street, it was a failure of economic analysis on the part of economists like Alan Greenspan. We want to spend a few minutes today with John Cassidy. He writes for The New Yorker magazine and is also author of the upcoming book, How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. And John, just start with your further thoughts on seeing Alan Greenspan, not just yesterday, but played back over and over again today.
Yeah, well, Greenspan's the man who never goes away, really. One might have thought, given his record over the last few years, you know, that media organizations would stop inviting him on. But I guess given that he was chairman of the Federal Reserve for 20 years, he's such a big figure that media bookers and journalists always want to seek out his views. But, you know, the fact is most of his economic views have been discredited in the last few years.
Well, he's not the only one who's had a hand in the economy in the last few years and has a voice now. There are people in the White House that some would say did the same thing. But let's lay out your thinking. You write that from the late 1990s on, under Greenspan, the Fed stubbornly refused to recognize that speculative bubbles, you know, those things, betting on things like sliced and diced bad mortgages, that these bubbles encourage the spread of rationally irrational behavior.
Right.
Explain that more.
Well, Greenspan's argument was always that you didn't have to worry about speculative bubbles in the stock market or in housing, which is what we had, obviously, in the last few years. He said it was better for the Fed to just sit it out, and when the bubble had burst, they could then cut interest rates and restore the economy to prosperity, that it wouldn't be a big shock to the system. What I'm arguing, and what lots of the other economists now argue, is that that's not right, that if you allow a speculative bubble to develop in housing, you encourage people to indulge in all sorts of very damaging activities, such as the one you mentioned, securitizing subprime mortgages, people buying homes they can't afford, people on Wall Street investing in things they don't really believe in.
And then subsequently, I just want to get to this rationally irrational behavior, because as you explain, what ends up happening is that banks and investment houses start taking these huge risks because everyone else is taking these huge risks.
Well, as I say, I mean, the phrase I use, rational irrationality, is because on an individual basis, it's quite rational for these bankers and CEOs to take big risks. In fact, it's more risky for them not to get involved in the bubble because in the short term, it's very profitable to trade these securities and to take on more risk. And if you're the CEO of a big bank and you don't do it and your competitors do, chances are you'll be out of a job before the bubble bursts.
Right.
So on an individual level, it's quite a rational thing to do, to play surf the bubble is the phrase I use.
Right.
But obviously, collectively, it's completely irrational and leads to sort of the sort of insanity that we saw in 2004 to 2006, when, you know, people who had no income, no jobs, no assets were getting mortgages.
Well, but as you further explain, people like Greenspan were believing in the teachings of Milton Friedman and Adam Smith, that markets were self-regulating, that whole invisible hand thing.
Right.
When we come back, I'm going to take a quick break, but I want you to talk about, well, actually, tell us now. You say they turned away from their traditional role. We'll set this up before our break. It was a punchline having something to do with a punch bowl. What was the traditional role of the Fed said to be?
Well, William McChesney Martin, who was the Fed chairman during the 50s and early 60s, he said the role of the Fed is to take away the punch bowl just as the party gets going, i.e. to be a spoil sport and stop sort of rational exuberance on Wall Street. Greenspan didn't do that.
Right. Well, we'll find out more about what you and others feel should happen, not just to Greenspan, but how about professors in schools like Harvard and how they're teaching the economy? Where do we go from here? How do you regulate rational irrationality, as you say? This is New Yorker magazine writer John Cassidy. Again, his upcoming book, How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. We'll talk more about the one we are sort of on the fringe of in 1 minute. Back in that minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with New Yorker writer and longtime business reporter John Cassidy, who's written recently about what really makes the economy so crash-prone. And John, you were just telling us of, you know, the past thinking about the Federal Reserve. The idea was to take away the punch bowl, you know, before the party crashed. But you also said the role traditionally of the Fed has been to ensure employment and stable prices. But you and others are suggesting to add to that the role should be to monitor risk. How would you do that?
Right. Well, I mean, it's part of a broader point. The Fed and Greenspan and people have traditionally taken the view that, you know, the free market pretty much solves everything. My argument and the argument of some other people is that that's not true in financial markets. The free market does a very good job of supplying most ordinary goods and services, such as clothes, food, golf clubs, whatever. but it doesn't do a very good job of providing financial products and financial services because it's prone to bubbles, speculative bubbles. So my argument, and as I say, it's not only mine, some people on Wall Street have been saying this, is that the Fed should also be formally given the job of preventing speculative bubbles and maintaining financial stability. At the moment, its formal mandate is to maintain stable prices and as high employment as possible. So what I'm arguing is there should be a third pillar to the Fed's mandate in order to prevent outbreaks of financial craziness as we've seen in the last few years.
But how would you do that? The New York Times has a timely report today, a front page piece we highly recommended on Simmons, the mattress company. Now,
right.
they're going to file for bankruptcy protection, even as the company's been bought and sold seven times in the last 20 years by private investors who then turn around and used it as a piggy bank, borrowing money against it, much like homeowners,
right.
Borrowed against their homes.
Yeah, I mean, it's the rise of leverage buyouts is sort of a separate question to the rise of speculative bubbles, but it does share one attribute, and that's it sort of justifies a more skeptical approach to Wall Street. If you're a free market economist, you believe that whatever Wall Street is doing is usually good for the economy. The financial markets exist to finance other businesses and to help innovation and growth. What we've seen at places like Simmons is that actually the investment bankers and the leverage buyout firms were just in it for themselves. They were motivated by making short-term profits. They were very short-term horizons, and they exploited the lax credit markets to, put enormous amounts of debt on these companies to flip them to one another for a few years. They all made excellent fees, but at the end of the process, Simmons Mattress and many other companies are left bankrupt, staggering under enormous debts, and they haven't actually been invested in very much. These companies don't tend to invest for the future. They tend to run the companies for very short-term profit.
But how would you regulate something like that? Would you not allow someone to lend them?
That's a very large question. I don't say, leverage buyouts should be... It should be banned from the world, although some people may say that. My argument is more intellectual one, that we need to take a more skeptical view overall. And if that involves limiting some of these activities and certainly eliminating some of the tax breaks there are for taking on debt, which exists throughout the system at the moment, then that's probably a good thing. As I say, I think the first thing to do is sort of it's an intellectual matter. People always say, you can't restrict these things, that's interfering with the market. In some cases, interfering with the market's not the wrong thing to do. It's the right thing to do.
Well, as you quote in another column from a year ago, people should pay more attention to Hyman Minsky. I'm speaking, of course, of the economist who said, unlike Milton Friedman or Adam Smith, he said, bankers, traders, and other financiers periodically play the role of arsonists, setting the entire economy on fire.
Right. Well, Hyman Minsky, very interesting guy, because he wasn't just an economist. He actually worked for a bank in St. Louis for many years. So he knew how the industry worked from the inside, and that made him a lot more skeptical about banking and finance than your average university economist. He saw at first hand how the banks, are driven by competitive pressures to lend to companies that don't deserve it and people don't deserve it during booms, and then during busts that we're seeing at the moment, to refuse to lend to people who do deserve it. So he had a much more skeptical approach and, in my view, a much more realistic approach to the financial system. And he was a strong supporter of the idea that the financial system should be much more heavily regulated.
Well, and how far would you go again? We've been asking, what do you suggest? You mentioned at one point that economists, inside the Fed, you feel that perhaps Greenspan should be obliged to somehow recognize his faults. But also outside, you mentioned something about there being a legal way to get at economists who somehow don't see the problems.
Well, I think it's, as I say, I think it's mainly an intellectual, a matter of intellectual debate here. I mean, we need some sort of national recognition that the policies we followed failed. Now, that obviously has to involve Greenspan, although he's never going to go along with it. Ben Bernanke is... sort of repudiate a bit of what he did in the past, but not formally. And the economics profession in general, as far as I can see, is largely in denial. I mean, the big economic debate within the economics profession at the moment, for example, is about whether the stimulus package works. And the arguments which are used against the stimulus package are very similar to the arguments that were used in favor of deregulation. So, you know, I think it's, not saying there's an easy way out of this, it's an intellectual dispute as much as anything else.
Well, but, and just in the minute or so we have left, how much should it go beyond the intellectual dispute? As you look at what the Obama administration is proposing for regulatory overhaul, just tick off a few things that you think should be considered.
I think, you know, the Obama administration proposals are a good start. Geithner came out with them at the start of this year. Myself and a lot of other people thought they seemed rather modest given the scale of the problem. And things like imposing bigger leverage ratios on banks, forcing them to hold more capital, forcing them to hold on to some of the securities that they produce. That all seems sort of very moderate, very sensible, but possibly not enough to restrain Wall Street. Now, however, the political climate's changed in the last 6 months, and it looks like even those very modest policies are not going to be introduced, or, you know, Congress is going to struggle to pass them. So at this stage, in my argument, I would say, you know, let's get the Obama regulatory reforms in place and then look whether they need to be beefed up in various ways. I think they do, but at this stage the political climate has shifted so much that even modest reforms look like they're in danger.
And some people believe that the whole opportunity is being missed and might
stay
missed.
Well, I mean, that's a larger question, obviously, whether the administration should have put financial reform through before healthcare.
Right. That's New Yorker magazine writer John Cassidy. John, we love when you drop by. Please do it again. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
His upcoming book, How Markets Fail, The Logic of Economic Calamities. Back in a minute, here and now. Former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is in Kenya today, calling on the coalition government to speed up reforms promised after post-election violence back in 2008. More than 1,300 people died when President Mwai Kibaki and opposition leader Raila Odinga both claimed victory. Under the power-sharing deal brokered by Annan, Kibaki is president, Odinga prime minister. Political reform is not the only problem facing Kenya right now. Relief agencies say an estimated 20 million people need assistance because of the worst drought in a decade, a drought which has also killed thousands of animals, devastating herders who depend on them for income and food. The BBC's East Africa correspondent Will Ross reports from Turkana in northwest Kenya.
Well, I can tell you, driving around Turkana district is extremely hot work. The air coming through the car window is like a load of hairdryers blasting in your face. Now, the landscape is desert-like, and just about the only sign of life here are a few homes dotted around, circular mud huts thatched with grass. There's sand everywhere and very little vegetation, just a few brown, thorny shrubs. In this dry, sandy riverbed, Turkana men and women have gathered. The women are on one side, most wearing a mountain of brightly coloured necklaces. The men are on the other, with traditional checked cloth tied around one shoulder, toga style. They're all in a crisis. Their animals are dying in alarming numbers.
Almost all the animals that are at the head, out of 20 goats, all have died.
He's lost all the 20?
All the 20. If no relief, then he will be lost. He will lose his life.
Kefas Ndangazi of the organisation Vets Without Borders tells me why the death of these animals is hitting the Turkana people so hard.
70% of the Turkana people are pastoralists. They entirely rely on livestock. Livestock, they get milk from livestock, they get meat from livestock, they sell livestock to get money to buy any other item or even base school fees. Livestock is the bank. They are losing everything they have, and therefore they are losing all their economy.
And this is certainly not a sight for vegetarians. Now, a number of goats are being thrown into this dry riverbed, and men are coming forward with small knives and slitting their throats. A number of them, it has to be said, had died already, and these ones are very weak. And then the women are picking up the dead goats and dragging them across and putting them on top of some leaves that have been laid out on the riverbed. And this is a huge, now open-air butchery. That's a girl in front of me who's just taken a metal bracelet off her wrist, and she's sharpening it on a piece of stone and is now skinning a goat. And it's not only the goats that are dying. Two camels have been brought here to be slaughtered. Even these normally drought-resistant creatures are succumbing to the effects of the drought. For Kefas Ndangazi, this is an especially worrying sign of how bad the situation is, and he says the decision to kill a weak camel is a very hard one for the Turkana.
A camel is the most resistant. They know it. That's where their last resort is. Your savings, your pension, this is it. If you see them slaughtering camels, they are throwing away the your pension, in modern terms.
The Turkana people are also in trouble because they live in a region where the violent theft of livestock is rife. And as the drought persists, there's more competition for the good land and the violence has escalated. Joseph Elim of an organisation called Riam Riam, which aims to protect the interests of the Turkana people, fears that the life of these herdsmen is going to get worse because the climate is changing.
Something significant has shifted. We can no longer say this is the time to have rainfall. So much increase of temperatures. If that's what we call climate change, then it has already come here with us.
People here tell me that the last decent rainfall was in the middle of last year. It's no wonder that some people here say God has become angry.
That report from the BBC's Will Ross in Kenya. Take a second for a reminder. You know, you can always listen to our program stream live at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can download a podcast of the program. You can take us with you wherever you want to go. That's at hereandnow.org. Up next, Singapore and China staking their futures on higher ed. What does that mean for the U.S.? That's in 30 seconds, here and now. American colleges and universities are considered the best in the world, a primary destination for foreign students. But is that changing? The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development reports that the U.S. does host a fifth of international students, but that's down from a quarter of those students in 2000. Part of the reason might be that while the economic slump has led to cuts at public universities in the U.S., Asian universities are pumping more money than ever into their higher education. Karen Fisher is with the Chronicle of Higher Education. Karen, what are some of the signs that tell you that the dominance of U.S. universities might be eroding?
I think it's still true that we're at the sort of the top of the heap in just about every academic or research quality indicator. But I think what people are a little bit concerned about is the fact that we're not improving at the rate that maybe some other countries are, that we're kind of holding steady. And so, for example, we still produce more scientists and engineers than almost any other country, but we really haven't produced any more in, you know, 2005 than we did 10 years earlier, whereas the Chinese, I mean, they've just skyrocketed. In 1995, they graduated 3,500 students with doctorates in science or engineering. Today, they graduate almost 15,000. And so it's just that kind of dramatic growth that I think has people really worried.
Well, and some would say countries like China had more to grow. You know, they had much further to go. But you have other stats. The U.S. share of highly influential research papers fell to 58% in 2003 from 63% in 1998. 4% of American college graduates major in engineering. That's compared to 13% in Europe, 20% in Asia. So there is some concern, but you do quote people who also say the sky isn't falling because they say, for instance, there may be more Asian degrees, but many of them don't meet U.S. course standards?
Yeah, I think that is something that people point out. And I think the other thing people will point out is other countries doing better doesn't necessarily mean that the United States is doing worse, because then there are a lot more smart, better trained people out there in the world who can tackle tough problems like, you know, climate change or hunger or infectious disease. They would say that it benefits everybody if these countries are doing better.
Well, and so you and the Chronicle looked at how some Asian countries are doing better, investing in higher education. Start with Singapore. What are they doing?
One thing that Singapore is doing is really trying to work with kind of the best of the best internationally. They're working, for example, with MIT to start some research institutions there. And they're really trying to put more money into their higher education system to really create a number of world-class institutions.
Well, and both China and Singapore can plan their education goals for up to 50 years in the future because it's a top-down system as opposed to from the universities up. Is that safe to say? It's from the government.
Yeah, I mean, and then there are benefits. I mean, I think one thing people would say is a benefit of a centralized system is that, you know, if the government says this is what we're going to do and they spend the money and it happens quickly. For example, I talked with Senator Lamar Alexander, the former Secretary of Education, and he told me a story about going to China and meeting with the president there. And this is about 5 years ago. And they talked actually a lot about these very issues that we're talking about, how to be more globally competitive. So it just happened in China. They had made the investments and they spent the money. And whereas here, they assembled a panel. The panel debated and discussed what's going on in higher education, and particularly in science and engineering. Then they issued a report. Senator Alexander and his colleagues in Congress took the report and drafted a bill that went through committees and got amended and debated and passed one house and not the other. And then it finally hit the president's desk, and then it had to get funded. And so it was a much more cumbersome process here in the United States. But he would actually argue that there's sort of benefits to this process, too, to having the more open debate versus somebody just dictating, this is what we're going to do and this is the direction we're going.
Well, let's stay with the process that he described. This is the America Competes Act. Mm-hmm. It was passed in 2007. What happened with it?
They passed it, but they didn't actually fund the bill right away. And so I think there was a little bit of a lag between the actual legislation going forward and the money that followed. And they have put more money into the bill, but it still hasn't kept up with, I think, what the sponsors of the legislation, like Senator Alexander, had conceived.
And what did they hope for?
They really hoped that we would be able to make a big dent in our production of scientists and engineers and really be much more aggressive so that we weren't holding in that steady state, but that we were like a China or a Singapore or Hong Kong, really leaping forward. I mean, their argument was, it's the people who have the best brains and the most cutting-edge technology that get ahead, and so we need to keep that advantage in this country.
So Lamar Alexander says it's a better process because it was more democratic, but it still ultimately didn't seem as if it got as much done as a direct order from, let's say, the Chinese government. You compare today to post-World War II, when federal support for academic research quadrupled in the 7 years after the launch of Russia's Sputnik. Does anyone say that that is possible now?
You know, I think people are kind of optimistic that the president has been talking about this. I mean, he got up in front of Congress earlier this year and he said, look, people, one of the three critical things that's going to happen for us to really have a healthy economic future is we need to invest in education. So I think people are optimistic, but they're pretty cautious, too, because it's very difficult in this country to develop the kind of national strategy that we've been talking about in Asia.
Well, President Obama not only spoke about education, but he's proposed spending $12 billion to improve community colleges, and the stimulus package includes money for student aid and academic research. So there's some movement.
There is some movement on the federal level, and I think people are heartened by the fact that President Obama is talking about colleges and universities. He's visiting them. He's paying attention to them. But the real challenge, I think, is that it's very difficult for the federal government to have a lot of sway on these issues because they don't have a lot of leverage. They don't. Even though the president has proposed spending this money on community colleges, still most of the money for higher education, particularly public higher education, is coming either from tuition or from state governments. The fact is that the share of higher education funding from the states has been steadily going downward for the last several decades.
Does anyone suggest that a greater investment in higher education will lead to economic growth?
That's exactly what we're seeing in Asia. They are treating as an article of faith that investing in higher education is going to be critical to their economic futures. I mean, economists would caution that it's a little bit more complicated than that, that there's things like tax policy and trade and just sort of a general climate of innovation that all kind of goes into the mix of making economies more competitive. But I do think that the economic situation is kind of helping spur the conversation and making people more aware of it. But the difficulty in this country, though, is to get people on the same page and moving in the same direction on these issues.
That's Karen Fisher of the Chronicle of Higher Education talking about a possible slippage in America in higher education as Asia rises. Karen, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. The summer she turned 15, New Yorker Michael Greenberg's beautiful and bright daughter Sally went mad. She'd probably been going mad for years, but one day in a playground near the East Village apartment she shared with her dad and his second wife, Sally was convinced that two little girls spoke to her telepathically. And soon Michael, who was a struggling writer, and his wife, a dancer, along with Sally's biological mom, Robin, a baker living in Vermont, all were descending with Sally into the incomprehensible world of mental illness.
Our pulses racing, We strained to absorb the sheer volume of energy pouring from her tiny body. She jabs at the air, thrusts out her chin. A cut-up performance, really. The overwrought despot forcing utopia down the throats of her poor subjects. But it isn't a performance. Her drive to communicate is so powerful, it's tormenting her. Each individual word is like a toxin she must expel from her body.
Michael Greenberg writes about that summer and beyond in his book, Hurry Down Sunshine, which is now out in paperback. We spoke with him when the book first came out and asked when he first realized that something was so wrong.
In retrospect, there were signs of tremendous kind of explosive vividness coming out of Sally, which I thought were within the realm of adolescent behavior on some level. She was 15 years old. In fact, I thought more than that. I was actually delighted at the way she was, in a way. She was reading Shakespeare's sonnets incessantly, writing in the margins, looking up every word, listening on a Walkman in those days, this was 1996, to Bach's Goldberg variations in a continuous loop. And I thought, wow, this is the efflorescence of my daughter.
What parent wouldn't be delighted? Shakespeare and Bach. And she was so eloquent. I mean, she was, you know, had a way with words. But then what? What was that breakdown day like?
We felt as if we had been overtaken by a force of nature, and I was completely unprepared for it, nor did I think that it was what it was. Sally had a vision. She had a world-saving, generous vision, which was that we were all born geniuses, and that Bach, Shakespeare, her heroes at that moment, weren't exceptional. They were just people who managed to hold on to the genius that were given in infancy and at birth. And if she could impart this to the entire world, we would be saved the suffering that the profaneness of living and society drums this out of us. And she tried stopping traffic on Hudson Street in the West Village in order to impart this to the drivers of the cars. She was pulled onto the sidewalk by a friend she was with at the time, brought home by police.
And there is a... It culminates in a knockdown, drag-out fight. She attacks you. I mean, there's a physicality that comes of it. She tears at your face. I mean, in the image that we have when we read this is of you just... This is your flesh and blood possessed.
And this is also what was so stabbing. This person who had learned to speak from me, who was as close to me in her frame of reference as anyone could be, had become impenetrable. And I found her delusions, her impossibility to connect with me, to resume our pre-manic conversation. I kept hoping for some remission. I thought perhaps she had taken drugs.
You're hoping it's drugs.
You're hoping it's drugs. What would be disturbing under normal circumstances to a parent were actually my great hope, because it offered a temporary solution, a temporary explanation, rather, to what had happened.
But you and Pat, your wife, Sally's stepmom, do get Sally to an emergency room. She goes with this sort of combination of imperiousness, as a queen would, but you also see windows of fear. What did they tell you there?
Sally is manic depressive, mm-hmm. and her presentation was severe mania, manic psychosis. Her symptoms were classic, apparently, and I couldn't fathom that the resident psychiatrist, when we went to the emergency room and she was finally seen by the psychiatric resident, could say to us after a 90-second interview with Sally, she has manic psychosis and needs to be hospitalized immediately. This is a medical emergency. Later, I came to realize that she could know that, in fact, to a psychiatrist, the symptoms were as clear as bronchitis would be to our general practitioner.
Well, Sally is hospitalized, and her world, this crazy, toxic world, starts to seep into you. You have physical fights with your wife that you're horrified about. At one point, you decide you're going to take Sally's medication when she's heavily medicated to see how she feels. What were you thinking? But also, you know, how did you feel?
It felt as if I had a bit part in a play that was called The Play of My Life, and I was watching it from the wings, and not only was my part tiny, but that I had missed my cue to go on stage. It's as if the own experience of your life is happening with you as a dull observer. This is why people go off their meds. People I've spoken to, Sally herself when she read the book, psychiatrists, have all told me that this is a very accurate description, this kind of seeing life through a plexiglass, through a scrim.
It gave you great sympathy for what she had to go through to get as well as she got.
by going on those medications.
Yes, and it was a little crazy to take it, I admit. Yeah. But my frustration, this was after she had left the hospital, and I wanted my daughter back. And I kept trying to reconnect with her, and I would try, and I would try, and I would fail, and it was like watching a death over and over again, and it was very stabbing to me. And so in the context of that frustration, I said, if I can't get her to come to me, I'm going to go to her, and I'm going to take the medication. So it was in that context that I did that rather crazy thing, but I'm glad I did.
Because?
Because I got the sense of what she had to contend with. You know, mania is on its first... in its first days, a medical emergency, and one has to be wrenched out. And one is wrenched out with these very crude medications, and a second transformation occurs, as astonishing as the first transformation to mania, which is stunning, the second transformation to this medicated...
zombie.
This medicated zombie with mania kind of wriggling under the surface like a cat in a zippered bag.
She goes through that zombie period. She does try school. She has tremendous successes. We learn in a postscript she falls in love, marries. She has setbacks. She separates. But how is Sally today?
It's a chronic illness, and she constantly has to deal with the looming possibility of a crack-up. Beyond that, she is a wonderful young woman who is a caring friend and a wonderful, valued member of her community. And I don't see her as a tragic figure at all. However, aspects of her life are thwarted. Three steps forward, and then she has to retreat.
But and tell us, though, why isn't that tragic in your eyes?
Sally's illness is an aspect of who she is. You know how we speak of mental illness in a different way? We say, I have diabetes. I have cancer, but I am schizophrenic. I am manic depressive. It's almost as if unconsciously, in the way we speak of it, we're talking about an aspect of being. And so how can I look upon Sally's very being as a tragedy?
Michael Greenberg, his book, Hurry Down Sunshine. By the way, the title, because I think of the song Hurry Sundown, the wonderful Peter, Paul, and Mary song.
Well, it does come from a song. It's a blues song, and it's a guy sitting in the deep south, can't wait to go to Chicago. It's called Going to Chicago. And he says, hurry down sunshine, see what tomorrow brings so he can get on the train. And to me, the phrase is about the scorching, bright, counterintuitive sun, not the nurturing sun, but the scorching sun of mania. That gave this kind of burning brightness to Sally. It's an incantation. Hurry down, sunshine, so we can get to the milder sunlight of real, steady life.
Hurry down, sunshine, and let's just see what tomorrow brings.
Michael Greenberg, author of Hurry Down, Sunshine, in a conversation we had when his book first came out. It's now out in paperback. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Nellie Mae Education Foundation, presenting sponsor of the Grantmakers for Education National Conference this week in Chicago, featuring Education Secretary Arnie Duncan.
PRI. Public Radio International.